Bruchim Aboyim to the second and continuing series of lectures on Rabbi Soloveitchik's Emergence of Ethical Man. We concluded last week by beginning speaking about the philosophical influences on Rabbi Yoshe Bael. We spoke about Kant and Hermann Cohen, whose philosophies come through and ring through such works as Halachic Mind, or more so actually Halachic Man, B'kashta Misham. But we noted that as there was a reaction, of what we call the reaction of immanence, against the philosophies of transcendence, of Kant and of Hermann Cohen. So one of the reactions against the philosophies of transcendence were philosophies of immanence, include among them Hegel, Buber, but the philosopher that we actually started speaking about was the French philosopher Henri Bergson. I actually mentioned last week that Bergson, who had nothing to do with Judaism's entire life, although he was a Jew, chose at the end of his life to be registered as a Jew. And then I said that he died. Actually, someone told me that he actually died. He had to stand on line with the Jews, and he caught pneumonia and died. Okay, now, what is the philosophy of Henri Bergson, and where do we see its impact on Rabbi Soloveitchik? I already mentioned last time two footnotes in the Halachic Mind. Rabbi Soloveitchik not only references Bergson, as he does in Emergence of Ethical Man, but there mentions Henri Bergson's revolt against the philosophies of transcendence. But what was Bergson's philosophy? Okay, so now, in Bergson, we have a philosophy, there's a metaphysics, I call it there's a metaphysics, there's a philosophy of ethics, and there's a philosophy of religion. Now, the philosophy of ethics is developed in his earlier works. The philosophies of ethics and religion are actually developed in his final work, which is his two sources of morality and religion. But what is Bergson's philosophy metaphysical? I'm calling it his metaphysics. Bergson basically created a philosophy out of the process of evolution. Bergson understood that matter has two aspects to it, two aspects to it. One was a mechanistic aspect, and one was what you might call a creative aspect. In other words, for the most part, matter functions in a very, very mechanistic way. However, there's a creative aspect of matter. He called this the Elan Vital, which I think is called the vital impulse, where matter acts in a creative way too. And this creative aspect of matter is the underlying metaphysical basis, or physical medical basis, for all forms of evolution. This was Bergson's philosophy. This is a notion what's called creative evolution. In other words, within matter, within science, you not only have the rules of mechanism, which perpetuates matter in according to the, you know, in the same forms, but also too you have inborn, intrinsic within matter a certain sense of creative force, and he called this the vital impulse, the Elan Vital. Now, this is Bergson's philosophy, and he has several books on this. This is not all of his philosophy. He has a very interesting, famous book about memory. But since it's not a course in Bergson, I'm not going to go into this in detail. In Bergson's last work, Two Sources of Morality and Religion, Bergson extends his metaphysics to ethics and then to religion. First, he speaks about ethics. According to Bergson, there's two aspects of ethics. There's what's called closed ethics, and is called closed morality, and is open morality. Okay? What he says is, and I'm going to actually re-quote from my notes, right? Closed morality is chiefly concerned with the survival of the social group at hand, and is a direct product of biological group survival, which we witness in all forms of species such as ants and bees. In other words, for Bergson, ethics is basically a person's connection with the society, and the rules governing society are the society's survival. So, for example, we see these forms of ethics, let's say in bees and in ants, that everybody works together for the good of the whole. I mean, sometimes they eat each other, whatever it is, but that's also for the good of the whole. That's called ethics. So Bergson understands that in human nature, in human societies, we have the same type of thing too. That man in society, will act, right, for purely survival needs, for the needs of society as they protect the members of that society. And this Bergson calls this closed morality. Because the purpose of this morality is just to protect the society at large. It might be that part of that protection is making wars in other societies. So this closed morality is not necessarily very open to other types of societies. But nonetheless, the purpose of this is closed society, and this is a type of an ethics. What ethics is? Because man will act today within an ethical system, right, in order to ensure the survival of the society at large. That's called closed morality. But then Bergson understands what's called an open morality. Open morality means, right, is that sometimes men will break away from the social environment and establish a new order. Right? And man does this by rejecting the old order and will establish a new order. So in other words, in a certain sense, closed morality is a type of vitalism on an ethical level. Open morality is a type of vital impulse, a creative morality, which establishes new orders. So that's why Bergson distinguishes what's called closed morality and open morality. Now, after Bergson finishes morality, he speaks about religion. There's what's called static religion and there's dynamic religion. Static religion means a person does what his religious society requires him to do. He acts within a religious society. Right? That's called static religion. And basically, a person does not create, necessarily, but what he does is he tries to adhere to the religious order of the community. And that's what Bergson calls static religion. But then there's something called dynamic religion, that sometimes a person will rebel against the religious community and try to establish another form of community or another form of a number layer of belief. And that's called dynamic religion. So in other words, we can look at the history of religion as basically having periods of what's called static religion, right? And then at certain points in history, we have a person who establishes a new order, he breaks away from the old order, and that's called dynamic religion. That's what Bergson says. And once again, the important thing to understand is that Bergson's theory, both of morality, ethics, morality, and his theory of religion, is really an extension of his metaphysics. In other words, the concept of mechanism versus vitalism. Okay? Now, it seems to me, I'm going to take two quotes from Rabbi Soloveitchik, which it would appear to me to be straight out of Bergson. Okay? He doesn't quote Bergson. On page 115, he speaks about, in other words, in The Emergence of Ethical Man, we have in the first chapters till, in other words, actually, that's his part three. Oh, wait, until page 145, until part one and part two, we have Rabbi Soloveitchik focuses on Adam HaRishon, first man, Adam HaRishon, Adam. And there he speaks about the emergence of ethics. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, I'm just quoting on page 115, this is a quote, you have to look at the entire context. So Rabbi Soloveitchik says, right, the fulfillment of my ethical duty consists in a cooperative performance and an act realized by two individuals. But that is not all. The divinely ordained task of man, in chapter 2, to till and tend the garden, la'avdu l'shamra, Adam 1, do you remember that? Creates a further impetus for collective life. The necessity of meeting life emergencies and exigencies cements the unity of the two. Solidarity in suffering and joy, in combating dead matter and defeating an indifferent environment, contributes to the steering of a sense of fellowship between human beings. That's closed morality. Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks about two individuals because he's speaking about Adam and Chava. But here we have in Rabbi Soloveitchik a definition of closed morality. That the ethics that I have towards the other is basically a cooperation that I need for what he says, combating things which threaten us. It's very, very interesting that Rabbi Yashaber sticks in a little bit of Bergsonian metaphysics. He says combating dead matter. Dead matter as opposed to the Ilan Vital, the active impulse. So here we see that Rabbi Soloveitchik understood the ethics of Adam HaRishon to be a form of what's called closed morality. Very, very Bergsonian. Okay, now, what about open morality, the individual? That which Bergson calls open morality, which is a function of individuals who break away from society, Rabbi Soloveitchik calls this the charismatic man. And the charismatic man we'll call the charismatic personality. And this is chapter 8 and begins, right, on page 149. Now, I want to read from Rabbi Soloveitchik. And Rabbi Soloveitchik raises a question. Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu order Avraham Avinu to leave or cast it and to go to Eretz Canaan? Okay? That's the question that he raises. Here's the question. I'm reading now from page 149. Why God could not enter into an intimate relationship with Abraham in Mesopotamia and have to guide him into a new land is an old problem. Yehuda Halevi in his Kuzari explains it with the uniqueness of the land of Israel as an ideal land for the meeting of God by man. In other words, there's something about Eretz Yisrael, as we all know from the Kuzari. He attributes metaphysical qualities to the land and endows it with a spiritual climate. Of course, the old myth of the temperate climate, which is ideal for the belt of man, was exploited by Halevi. Nachmanides, in his commentary to Vayikra, followed in Halevi's footsteps, as did the mystics, as the Ramban. For them, the attribute of Kedusha holiness ascribed to the land of Israel is an objective metaphysical quality inherent in the land. Rabbi Soloveitchik now is going to disagree. Writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, with all my respect for the Rishonim, I must disagree with such an opinion. I do not believe that it is halakhically cogent. Kedusha, under halakhic aspect, is man-made. More accurately, it is a historical category. A soil is sanctified by historical deeds performed by a sacred people, never by any primordial superiority. The halakhic term Kedusha Sa'aretz, the sanctity of the land, denotes the consequence of a human act, either conquest, heroic deeds, of course, that's called Kedusha Rishayna, or the mere presence of the people in that land. That's called Kedusha Shniya. Kedusha is identical with man's association with Mother Earth. Nothing should be attributed a priori to dead matter. Objective Kedusha smacks of fetishism. I believe, rather, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, that the divine commandment to Abraham to leave his parents' land and go to the land of Canaan should be understood under a different aspect entirely. Okay, now let's get ready for open morality or dynamic religion. The charismatic personality, hear this, Hatzachai, must disassociate himself from his natural connections and completely free himself from the environment he was born and reared in. The chosen person severs his affiliation with his clan and friends. He deserts everybody in order to give himself to his new friend, God. The first prerequisite for prophecy is loneliness. A lonely man finds a lonely God, and his very loneliness creates the charismatic bond between them. The charismatic person must lose his country and home and becomes a miserable stranger and strange wanderer. Arami Oyved Avi, a strange Syrian was my father. Now that shouldn't shock you, because in Haggadah Shel Pesach, Midashin that's going on Lavan. But I claim that that's a drush of Chazal on that Pshuta Shel Mikra. V'haraya, the Mishnah says, V'deresh me'arami oivet ovi atzoiv kol ha'parsha. Ein mikra yosei b'shutai. That's the way the Rashbam learns, by the way. The Maharal, of course, attacks him. In any case, let's go further to page 152. Says the Rashbam of Eichuk, in the straying of Abraham from his father's house, the motive of freedom and revolt comes to the fore. This is very Bixonian. Open morality is revolt against the closed morality. The charismatic person is anarchic, freedom-loving, and anti-authoritarian. I don't remember anywhere when Avraham Avinu was referred to an art scroll as anarchic, freedom-loving, and anti-authoritarian. Obviously, Rabbi Soloveitchik is explaining Avraham Avinu in terms of what's called dynamic religion, open morality. So we see here clearly that Rabbi Shabel has adopted Bergsonian ethics and religious philosophy in understanding the difference between the portrayal of ethics as relates to Adam and Chava, that's closed morality within a society, and the portrayal of ethics of Avraham Avinu, who's the first of the charismatic personalities. That's Rabbi Soloveitchik. Okay. There's no doubt about it that the emergence of ethical man, right, is confronting us, or presents us with a Bergsonian interpretation of the Chumash. From Maisa Bereishis to, in fact, actually Adam HaRishon, and after that, Yishamei goes to Meshavei, and we'll speak about this in later lectures. This is very, very clear. Okay. I want to go back now and speak a little bit about Bergsonian's metaphysics. Okay? And this is very, very important, because this is actually going to relate a little bit. Up to now, we've spoken about the philosophical sources of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Now we're going to speak about what we call the hashkafic, the religious sources of Rabbi Soloveitchik, within the Messiah, within the tradition of Judaism. Now, very, very interesting that what is the concept here that within matter, within mechanistic matter, there's a vital impulse, a ilan vital. What is this ilan vital that's inherent within matter? Okay. We all know, those of you who have listened to hashkafasirul.com, the so-called the Glor, that there was a very, very famous machlekes, a dispute between the Balatanya and the Nefesh HaChaim on the Tzimtzum. Okay? Some people don't believe it was a dispute, but we believe it's a dispute. In any case, this dispute was actually a dispute between one of Rabbi Soloveitchik's ancestors, Rabbi Chaim Voloshana, and between the Balatanya. What the Balatanya? And to put it simply, the question was, how does a Kodesh Baruch Hu reveal himself from the perspective of man? Right? Like the Zohar says, that a Kodesh Baruch Hu is both Malakol Almin, the Savior of Kol Almin, right? And one aspect is from the standpoint of man, and one aspect from the standpoint of God. Which one was it? So the Baal HaTanya understood that from the perspective of man, Kodesh Baruch Hu begins as Seva Kolamim. This is in the Shah HaYichud V'Amun of the Baal HaTanya. And Kodesh Baruch Hu mitzamtzim himself, constricts himself, takes the infinite light of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, kiv'yochol, constricts itself within finite reality. That's called the Tzimtzum according to the Baal HaTanya. The Gur in the famous letter called the Sminus. We're not going to go into the Shiva Gur. So in other words, as far as the Baal HaTanya was concerned, man's connection with the Kodesh Baruch Hu is through immanence. That means that the Or Ein Sof, which is mitzamtzem within the physical world. That's the Shita of the Baal HaTanya. V'chai V'loshana, as most of you know from Shaul Gimel, argued on this. V'chai V'loshana held that no, God's immanence is from the God point of view. Man relates to God through transcendence, Seif of Kol Alma. And that he understood the Tzimtzum Kav of the Ari, the Tzimtzum is immanence, which is the God point of view. The Kav, which is from man's standpoint, that's Seif of Kol Alma, that's transcendence. Okay. You go through this and decide for yourself. But this is, in fact, the famous Machloikes, the Baal HaTanya, and the Nefesh HaChayim. Okay, now. What is Rabbi Soloveitchik's position on the Tzimtzum? Now, I mean, clearly, the Bergsonian concept of a creative impulse within dead matter seems to suggest, especially if I identify that with ethics, seems to suggest the perspective of the Baal HaTanya. But not necessarily. I could say that all of this is also physical too. But in any case, it seems to suggest the perspective of the Baal HaTanya. Okay? Now, I want to read to you, right? I want to read to you from page 49, chapter 3 of Emergence of Ethical Man, chapter 3, page 49. Okay? He speaks about the dynamic nature of divinity. Locomotion is one of the traits of life. This was known to both the Hebrew and the Greek of old. Okay? In speaking of God, the Bible never neglects to emphasize the dynamic aspect. God is identified with ceaseless movement, whether in the sense of continuous activity, like the creation of, or eternal vigilance over the universe or locomotion. God comes and goes, visits the world and departs. The divine spirit is dynamic and restless. And he brings the passage, Ruach denotes both the spirit and wind for a simple reason. Wind symbolizes motion, activity, and speed. Phenomena that are indispensable for a living being. Okay, now. Okay? So he says, like this. God is eternal, urgency, and activity. He's compelling and alive. He comes and goes, descends and returns to a transcendent abode. However, even divinity is confined, quote, to a specific locus. We cannot help but notice the intent of the Torah to arrest divinity within concrete bounds. That's the Baal HaTanya. The Sinaitic revelation demonstrated the inapproachability of God. His otherness and destructiveness on the one hand, and divine urgency and impetus on the other. Immediately after, God commands Moses, and let them make me a sanctuary. Apparently the Torah knew that while the dreadfulness and transcendental repulsion free divinity from all existing ties with this world, the moment of fascination attractiveness tries to achieve almost the impossible, to introduce God into a concrete, confined, or abode. There is a definite tendency to imprison the infinite transcendental deity within the bounds of our concrete universe. The source of this concept is Chesgel's famous epiphany, Baruch Kavod Hashem Im Koimoi, a phrase which the Goyen mentions in his Cherem on the Chassidim. God has a makom, a place. Who's that? That's a Nefesh HaChayim, Shaul Gimel. Don't, right? God imposes voluntary imprisonment on himself by his own free will, arrests himself within the confines of a cosmic order in general, and within a hallowed abode in particular. Then he brings him Shlomo HaMelech. Okay? In this wonderful prayer, Solomon formulated the most paradoxical mystery of divinity. The infinity universally on the one hand, and self-contraction on the other hand. This is Mamis L'Shoinus of the Baal HaTanya. The Pele, the Pechina Malchus, as the angel of the infinite light of God can what? Can be mitzamtzem itself within the physical. That's the nais of the Tzimtzum. Freedom and continuous movement under one aspect confined within certain bounds and another. Okay? It brings a medrash. Now, does this have to do with the Tzimtzum? Maybe not. No, it does. Page 52. Moses could not reconcile God's transcendence with self-limitation. According to the Medrash, God revealed himself the mystery of Tzimtzum. Apparently, life is expressed in the parameter of freedom, confinement, etc., etc. Okay, very good. Now, so what is Rabbi Shabir saying? Rabbi Shabir saying is that we have this concept of tzimtzum, where the Ein Sof, in fact, actually confines itself within physical world, physical matter, which is very, very much the Baal HaTanya. Not very much. It is the Baal HaTanya. There's the Baal HaTanya in Germanic English. Now, of course, he's going to speak about this a little bit later on, about man's relationship with the earth, that man actually, right, is within the bounds of nature. But this is the sheet of the Baal HaTanya. It turns out the sheet of the Baal HaTanya has the most affinity with Bergson's philosophy of the Ilan Vital. This self-impulse, this dynamic process, which is inherent within mechanistic matter. So Bishop Soloveitchik has done is he's made here, right, this very interesting analogy between Bergsonian metaphysics and the sheet of Tzimtzum, the Baal HaTanya. Now, lest you think, well, he just had an interesting moment. I want to say something very interesting. A similar passage appears in none other than Halachic Man. The quotes that I read to you last time about the Kantian view of the world that's expressed in Halachic Man, Rabbi Soloveitchik expresses in the beginning. On page 49 in Halachic Man, Rabbi Soloveitchik takes a turn. He speaks about the mystery of symptom of contraction. And much of the language that he speaks about, uses here, the Midrashim, the Psukim, in Malachim, he brings in Halachic Man too. On which I want to raise a question, but I'm going to address this only at a later lecture. Could it be that in Halachic Man, Rabbi Soloveitchik was already making a turn from Briskian, Kantian, Reb Chaim Dick transcendence to a type of contraction and immanence? That's my question. By the way, this is very, very interesting that it always, this question always bothered me. If in fact actually Halachic Man is Reb Chaim, is Reb Chaim Volozhin, the a priori ontological Torah, why is he describing Tzimtzum in Tanya terms? Could possibly be a Halachic Man, there's also a turn from the Torah of the Aveis to the Torah of the Banim. But that will leave for another time. Oh, so now what we have here is a very, very important fact, a very, very important way of which Rabbi Soloveitchik understands the metaphysics of God, Kadosh Baruch Hu's relationship with the world, is that there's a contraction of the Or Ein Sof. And this contraction lends itself to a very creative, vital, impulsive understanding both of what? Both of the metaphysics of the physical world. Metaphysics, we're speaking about the Or Ein Sof within the physical world. But in addition to that, this actually is the groundwork by which Rabbi Soloveitchik develops his theory of ethics and morality. So in other words, the Baal HaTanya looms in the background, certainly, in The Emergence of Ethical Man, and actually, interestingly enough, is in the second part of Halachic Man too. Now, the question, right, the question that has to be asked is that What is this concept which he understands to be closed morality? In other words, if we go back actually to the passage which I read, there he speaks about Adam and Chava and speaks about a relationship with a partner. The relationship with a partner is actually a metaphor or a precedent or a model of the relationship within society. And that's what Rabbi Soloveitchik says. He says, right, the necessity of meaning life.
Which page is this?
On page 115. I'm reading over again what I read before. Right? Is the divinely ordained task of man in chapter 2 to till and tend the garden, right, creates a further impetus for collective life. The necessity of meaning life, emergencies, and exigencies cements the unity of the two. I read this already. Solidarity and suffering and joy. in combating dead matter and defeating a different environment contributes to the stirring of a sense of fellowship between human beings. And then he goes on and says, hence, the ethical must be fruitful and multiply, right? Right? Pu'uvu. And the imperative survival in a callous, uncooperative setting force, the I to overcome its aloofness and aloneness and join the alien thou. In other words, Rabbi Soloveitchik understands that pu'uvu is actually an ethical act. Now, what's interesting is pu'uvu appears in two places in the Chumash. It appears after Noach, where the commandment is given to what? Given to the Bnei Noach, to man. But it also appears, too, in Sheishit by Bereishis, by the Dagim. So in other words, what we have over here is an ethical, it's a command. Being a command, it's an ethical act, but it's an ethical act that's not independent of a natural precedent. Right? Both the Ao and the I and the Thou are separately united in a common effort, in a primeval unity. It is existential oneness and identity brought forth by the inter-individual ethical consciousness. So in other words, according to Rabbi Yehoshua Ben, what we have is that the beginnings of ethics, which actually is ordered by the command of Pilarivya, which of course assumes the existence of a chava, right, of an isha, this actually represents, he understands the relationship between Adam and Chava. What Adam and Chava represents is the precedent, represents what we call close morality. That the two individuals, in fact, actually come together in a cooperative effort in order for their own self-interest. And this is how he understands Adam and Chava. This, in turn, as I also mentioned, is based upon a metaphysics that, in fact, actually, the divine ethic is inherent within the physical realm. And this is, of course, rooted metaphysically, the makor of which is in the Baal conscious concept of Tzimtzum. So this here represents, we have here these two sources of what I would call influence on Rabbi Soloveitchik's thinking. There is the sheet of Tzimtzum of the Baal HaTanya. That's from the religious side. And from the philosophical side, I'm not saying that the Baal HaTanya is necessarily a philosophy, not a philosophy, but right. And from the philosophical side, there is the philosophy of Bergson, which are in fact philosophies of immanence. These are philosophies of immanence. Okay? An interesting question that has to be raised is that the objection of Nefesh HaChaim to the Baal HaTanya was an interesting objection. Nefesh HaChaim said that if, in fact, from the man's side, Mamala Kol Almim, Kodesh Baruch Hu's filling of the physical world from the man's side, so therefore, says the Baal HaTanya, says the Nefesh HaChaim, this can negate the halacha. Because the halacha, by its very existence, the halacha, by its very essence, posits distinctions between different places. So, for example, the Nefesh HaChaim argued on the Baal HaTanya that if Malay Chalatz Kavayde is from man's perspective, why is a person allowed to make brachas in the base medrash, but not allowed to make brachas in unclean places? In other words, the Nefesh HaChaim understood that the sheet of the Baal HaTanya represented a threat to the halachic system, which posits by definitions differences between different places. That was the Nefesh HaChaim's claim on the Baal HaTanya. And because of that, Nefesh HaChaim reversed the man side and the God side of the Tzimtzum. Now, what's interesting is, how does Rabbi Soloveitchik deal with this? Because Soloveitchik, of course, is Isha Halacha, halachic man. And don't think there's no halacha in the emergence of ethical man. In this piece that I read, his objection to the Kuzi of the Rabbah was based upon the halacha. And Rabbi Soloveitchik spends a long time in understanding, in fact, actually, in other words, making this connection between man's immanence and the halacha. So, for example, the plant aspect of man is realized in the halachas of Zerayim. And the animal aspect of man is realized in what's called the Hilchos Ba'al Chalos HaSuros. Okay? I'm quoting Rabbi Soloveitchik in page 76, where he says, Adam is still an animal crawling in the jungle, still the ape which is aware of its needs. So these are different aspects of man which express themselves in the halakha. So what we have to raise the question is, how does Rabbi Shabel square this Bergsonian Balatanya, Lahavdil, axis with the halacha? And the answer to this is actually going to be something we're going to speak about in Mergers of Vatagman, that Rabbi Soloveitchik understands the Torah as being a halacha which is rooted in man's natural being. And it's precisely here where he sees the important differences between Judaism and Christianity. Christianity understands that man, I'm using my Slavic language, is a transcendental being. He's removed from the physical. The physical, the natural, is sinful according to Christianity. Whereas Judaism understands that man, in addition, of course, to having a tzelem Elokim, to having a metaphysical component, right, also is rooted in the natural world. And the spiritual content of the natural world is expressed in the halakha. So, in fact, understanding the Balatanya-like tzimtzum, not in what's called kinematic terms, but in natural terms, Rabbi Soloveitchik is able to learn the Balatanya in a way in which the Alta Zeder of Chaim Volozhiner would have seen that there is a resolution between the tzimtzum of the Balatanya, between Baal's imminence and the halachic process. This is one of Rabbi Soloveitchik's incredible, I call it chidushim, but the credible themes of this amazing work, The Emergence of Ethical Man. Now, I mentioned before, and I just want to sort of mention this a little bit afterwards, that Rabbi Soloveitchik's discussion of the tzimtzum in page 49 of halachic man, right, is very, very much immanental too. Very much in the tradition of the Balatanya. In fact, a lot of the sources in The Emergence of Ethical Man, he actually presents to us, in fact, actually, in halachic man. Which is very, very interesting, because his concept of Torah is some kind of illusion out there. Torah is the a priori, we quoted last time, from the very Kantian understanding of the Torah, right? Which, of course, is much more apropos to the tzimtzum of the Nefesh HaChayim, where in fact, actually, man's relationship to the world is out of transcendence. But in fact, actually, in a certain sense, right, as we see, Rabbi Soloveitchik certainly, in fact, actually, speaks about tzimtzum later on in the book as in fact actually being being at the process of immanence, which Darshani. Is there a steal in the book? I can imagine scholars 100 years from now, Bashir Tazel Kong Chas V'Shon, will say maybe with two Rabbi Soloveitchiks. Rabbi Soloveitchik number one, Rabbi Soloveitchik number two.
Pseudo Soloveitchik,
whatever it is, okay? It turns out, is that this discussion is a very long discussion, which in Yitz Hashem maybe will actually push off to one of the later lectures, so I can leave you a little bit of suspense, what my shita is of halachic man. But needless to say, in my opinion, halachic man has been completely misunderstood by the scholars, as one of those people who are, who are talmidim of his. But in any case, this in fact concludes what I have termed to be the very important Bergsonian influence, and let's call it, at least right now, the Bergsonian turn in Rabbi Soloveitchik from halachic man into the emergence of ethical man. Now, these are really introductions and hakdamas. Beginning next week, in Mirat Hashem, we are actually going to commence the work and read from the work. We'll try to read in order, that might be difficult, from the work, and actually go through and see how Rabbi Soloveitchik actually realizes these themes in practice, okay? But until then, from an undisclosed place in Yerushalayim, until next week, Kol Tov.